This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The fabric of America's patchwork of marijuana laws changed yet again last week. Five states had the question of recreational marijuana use on their ballots, and four said yes, including two New Hampshire neighbors, Massachusetts and Maine. Meanwhile, the Granite State has among the most restrictive laws in New England, and the drug remains illegal under federal statute. Today in The Exchange, how marijuana fared on Election Day. Let's hear from you, your questions about what other states are doing, and your thoughts on the impact on New Hampshire of these two bordering states' legalization. Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org or share your thoughts on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Carmen Hansen, program manager at the National Conference of State Legislatures. She's been following marijuana policy in the states for at least a decade. Carmen, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
And joining us for our first half is Susan Sharon. She's deputy news director at Maine Public. She's going to tell us what's been happening in Maine. And Susan, thank you for taking time out.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, Carmen, to you first, give us the big picture. How many states and how many people, just roughly, are now living in places where adult marijuana use is legal?
Thanks. Yes, it is currently now eight states in the District of Columbia where adults are allowed to use marijuana for what they call recreational purposes. We tend to refer to it as adult use retail or legalized regulation and use and sales.
So eight states and D.C., Carmen.
Yes.
And I think I read maybe this even from you that these eight states and D.C. cover, what, 20% of the population? Is that right?
It's roughly 20-25. I haven't crunched the numbers myself, but I've been seeing 20-25% of the country, yes.
That's a lot. I mean, I was surprised that it was that much. Any surprises, Carmen, for you from election night, from these five states that four of them went in favor of legalization?
They were all pulling pretty strongly, with the exception of Arizona was always very tight. And Maine was also very, very tight. Actually, last I saw, the vote count difference was only about 3,000. And I think Susan probably has the even more up-to-date than that as far as those numbers. But they were pulling, you know, in the high 50s, most recent to the election.
Okay, so Susan, it was very close in Maine, as Carmen is saying. What's the latest?
The latest is it looks like the opponents will ask for a recount. They have until 5 o'clock tomorrow to make their intentions clear. They've got to gather some petition signatures to make it official. But it looks like they will ask because the margin is less than 5,000 votes. I think it's about 4,400 right now. And some people think, you know, it will hold, but the opponents, given how close it was, how tight it got in the last weeks before the election, they think that they, you know, owe it to their group to make sure that those votes will stand.
Well, and we'll hear a little bit later in the show from a reporter in Massachusetts where the vote was a lot less close than in Maine. Why was it so close, Susan?
You know, I think there were a combination of factors. Some interesting dynamics. For one thing, we have a strong medical marijuana industry in Maine. We were one of the first states to legalize medicinal marijuana, and it's been going strong for about 3 years now and doing well, and it's sort of held up as a model for medical marijuana in the country. That was one interesting aspect. So there were people, caregivers and people in rural Maine, where marijuana prior to legalization for medicinal purposes, where it was part of the underground economy, you know, this unspoken way that people made a living. And when they finally came out into the light and got legit and, you know, had licenses and patients and, you know, could make some money from it, they were very happy. And so there's this weird divide between some who work in the medical marijuana industry and those who don't about a fear that big marijuana might Bigfoot them and take over. But then there were also the usual concerns, a lot of concerns about impaired driving from law enforcement and what that might do. The Maine Attorney General came out in the last couple of weeks before the election and said there was this weird problem with wording in the measure and that kids would actually be able to use, even though that wasn't what the proponents intended. And then we also had the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture and Conservation, which would be the regulatory agency, saying he had concerns that his department would not be able, might not be able to manage this, that it might deplete resources from, you know, agriculture, conservation, and forestry needs. So those were some of the things that happened at the last minute on top of what you normally hear about the concerns about marijuana legalization.
Well, wow, lots to dig into. And Carmen, to you, I'm interested in this divide between medical marijuana folks and those promoting legalized recreational marijuana. I've heard about this in other states. Give us a little bit more there, Carmen, please, on some of the concerns between these two communities.
Sure. The concern that you tend to see, and I'm going to be speaking in some generalizations, but there isn't necessarily anything stereotypical about the populations. I just want to clear that up. You will generally hear in states that have a medical program, if there is a push for legalization, that they want to make sure that the interest and the access for patients in the medical program does not change. They want to make sure that if there is a difference in taxes, that there's a different tax applied for the medical use products versus the adult use retail products. They just want to make sure that their system doesn't necessarily somehow go out the window or get changed for that would have a potential negative patient impact.
So costs, access, taxes, and so forth. People under the medical marijuana system, Carmen, want to make sure, you know, they like it, it's working for them, and they want to make sure that doesn't get mucked up. Have we seen that happen in states that had medical and then went to legalizing recreational? Have we seen the medical system get impacted by that, Carmen?
We've seen some changes in dispensary laws. Colorado most recently has now started more stringent testing for products in both the medical and the adult use side. So in some ways, people think that's a better thing because you're getting more products tested for purity, consistency, molds, mildews, any other kind of contaminations. So that is sometimes brought into the medical side to kind of update them, to kind of make them a little more modern compared to some of the older medical programs that may not have those kinds of, you know, higher level of regulation and testing.
Well, again, the number for you to join us here in the exchange as we look at legalizing recreational use of marijuana for adults. On the ballot, five states looked at this, four said yes, including two New Hampshire neighbors, Massachusetts and Maine. We're looking at what these two states are doing, and we'll talk a little bit about what this might mean for New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can share your thoughts on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Susan, in Maine, with the caveat that Maine is still in flux, very close, what would this proposal do and what wouldn't it do? What would be allowed and what wouldn't be allowed, Susan?
Well, for one thing, you would not be able to walk down the street and smoke a joint. You couldn't use in public, same as you can't now. It basically sets up a framework for regulating and taxing marijuana for people would be able to possess up to 2.5 ounces if they were 21 and over, and that's more than most other states. I think it's double. And you could grow some for yourself. You could have 6 mature plants and 12 immature plants you could grow for yourself. And it also establishes licensing for social clubs, which is different than other states. Those are would be something like bars where you could use on site. You could use marijuana on site. And then, but right now, if this does indeed pass in Maine, there's also a whole bunch of rules that will have to be established around, you know, setting up the licensing and, you know, packaging and even what kind of edibles would be allowed and, you know, seed to sale tracking, all of those things.
Well, and in terms of homegrown, Susan, how do you tax homegrown? That seems impossible. You can't go door to door and you know, see what people have out back.
That's a good question. You know, the tax here is a 10% tax on sales of recreational marijuana. And by the way, there would not be one for medical marijuana. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic as well to see whether people stick with the medical market instead.
So homegrown is allowed. Is the state saying, Susan, that they will try and tax home growers, or only if those home growers try and sell it to their friends?
I'm not clear about that yet. I'm not sure if that's part of the rulemaking that has to get underway. But you know, yes, you could grow it for yourself. I think the transfer, the sale, is the problem or the issue, and I'm not sure how that would work.
Yeah, and recognizing again that it's all new and shaking out and hasn't even been fully decided yet, as you said, Susan. But Carmen, what about other states? How are they dealing with home grow versus retail, taxing versus, you know, it's your own marijuana and we're not going to come to your door and tax you?
Sure, yeah. Most states that allow homegrown or home grows in the adult use legal states do not have any kind of taxing, or they're not tracking anything. You don't have to report how many plants you're growing to the state. There's no kind of ideally a very private issue if that's what you're doing. You're in Colorado, you're allowed 6 plants per adult, 3 of which can be flowering. So it sounds maybe like it's a little smaller quantity than Massachusetts, but there is, you know, the idea is that you're not selling it to your friends and things like that. That would be kind of considered the gray market, assuming that people can go purchase products from the dispensaries otherwise. So there's really no regulation of the private home grow situation.
So regardless of how you feel about, you know, how anyone feels about legalization or not, it sounds like, Carmen, a whole lot of new rules, regulations, and frankly, work for law enforcement.
It can be, sure. You know, some of the arguments are that if you legalize, it will free up officers to work on other issues. But there are still issues related to the enforcement of the new marijuana laws. So it's like you may not be writing tickets for people that are selling on the street if those numbers go down, but you might have things like public use infractions can go up. But it really just depends. Sometimes that is it's a low-level crime. You may or may not see local law enforcement choosing to go after those, you know, lower-level, you know, $100 fines or whatever it may be in your particular municipality.
Susan, you touched on this earlier, but I'd love to ask you a little bit more about Maine law enforcement. Carmen's right. We often hear, you know, if we weren't paying so much attention to enforcing marijuana laws, police could focus on really important stuff like, you know, high-level crime and opioids and so forth. What are police in Maine saying about that?
Well, most of the police here seem to have come out against question one, which was the recreational marijuana question. And the big thing, as I mentioned earlier, was really their worry about people operating while impaired. You know, that would still be a crime, but it's difficult to enforce because there's no marijuana corollary like there is to blood alcohol threshold in Maine of 0.08. So there's that big worry. They also think that, you know, they're going to be diverted to dealing with problems that arise on the road and so forth, compared to what they're already dealing with, which is a terrible opiate epidemic in Maine. And you know, even though the revenue from this tax is supposed to potentially help go to the general fund and help, you know, potentially help law enforcement, they're just very skeptical about that. They just think that it's just going to create more problems for them, particularly around impairment.
Well, let's take some calls, both of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Let's hear from you, your questions, comments, thoughts about what Maine and Massachusetts are trying to do, and your comments on what this might mean for us in New Hampshire. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Susan and Carmen, Bob joins us from Amherst. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I had a specific question about operating under the influence of drugs. If you fail to take the breathalyzer, there's an automatic loss of license. Is there a provision in law or proposed provision if someone fails to take a drug test? Well, would there be a loss of license?
Sure, and a lot of this is still uncertain. But, Susan, you just said a minute ago that, first of all, there isn't sort of an on-the-road test for marijuana impairment. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. That's the problem.
So, Carmen, how do police in states where marijuana is legal already deal with this, impaired driving, and whether you can yank someone's license if you can determine that they are that they're impaired, or if they refuse to take the test, as Bob asks?
Sure. In some of the existing adult use states, or even in some of the medical states, if an officer believes that you are under the influence of anything, they have the ability to do like a traditional roadside for alcohol, or if they think it's marijuana, they need to actually take you into the police department and have a blood draw. And most of it is the laws, at least I know, in Colorado and Washington are 5 nanograms of THC per milliliter of blood. And that's kind of a presumed high, so to speak, limit. So if you have consumed and then you went into the police department and the blood sample was shown to have 5 nanograms or more of THC, it's your presumed high. Whether or not you are actually impaired is a complete other question, which makes this area, because there is no roadside, very controversial. And there are companies right now doing some clinical trials and roadside trials on saliva tests and kind of breath tests. But again, they may or may not be measuring impairment. They're just measuring the amount of something in your system.
So wow. So
that's the criticism with them.
So there's no roadside test for marijuana high or whether you're impaired from marijuana. So a police officer would have to haul you in, Carmen, draw blood there at the police station. And then how long does that take to determine that level of THC that you mentioned? This sounds like a long process.
Sure. It could take, you know, if someone has some sort of rapid test, it could be a few hours or it could be, you know, up to 2 weeks or longer, depending on, you know, how the lab in that area is processing samples.
Well, thank you for the question, Bob. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Kyle in Berlin who says, "We are going to lose a lot of tourists to Maine, considering their state is similar to ours." Kyle says we could lose a lot of money that could help schools, etc. Let's talk, Susan, a little bit more about the money. You said a 10% tax. What were some of the ideas that were thrown around during the debate leading up to this question on how much money might come in, how this money would be used? There's always a lot of hope for a new pot of money.
There sure is. Well, one thing, you know, that was looked at was whether Massachusetts would also legalize, because I think the revenue picture starts to change if people can go to Massachusetts and Maine to buy and, you know, to spend their tourist dollars. So, you know, originally the estimate was that Maine, with this 10% tax on recreational marijuana, would generate about $10 million a year in tax revenue. And it's not a huge amount of money, and some of that would obviously have to go towards the regulatory framework, and most of it would go to the general fund. 98% would go to the general fund, and there was talk of, I think, a big push was really the idea that it could be used to help. We don't have enough drug treatment in Maine, drug treatment for, you know, this terrible opiate problem, and so that some of it could be used for that, and some of it could be used for school, some of it could be used for education and training for law enforcement. So not really clear yet how it's all going to fall out. I think the numbers do shrink now that Massachusetts has also entered the picture.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks for the call. Kyle, for the email. We'll hear from you in just a moment. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk to a Massachusetts reporter about the vote for marijuana legalization there and more on Maine. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, marijuana on the ballot. Several states this past election day approved adult recreational pot. We're finding out more, including what it might mean for New Hampshire. So as we look at how Maine and Massachusetts might present their legalizing marijuana, we want your thoughts and questions and comments. What do you think the impact might be on New Hampshire? Do you think New Hampshire should follow the path of its neighbors, or carve its own path. Also, just your questions about what these two states are doing are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can post a comment on Facebook at NHPR Exchange. Carmen Hansen is with us. She has been following marijuana policy in her role as program manager at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Also joining us from Maine, Susan Sharon, Deputy News Director for Maine Public. And Susan, another question for you, please. What about local zoning? If a town, for example, doesn't want a marijuana store in its borders, right downtown, whatever, what rights does it have?
That's a great question. In this framework, there is absolutely the ability for any city or town to decide whether they want to control the number of retail stores in their vicinity, whether they want to put additional licensing requirements on them, and they also have the ability to prohibit them if they so desire. So there is local control. And if a municipality wants to impose new rules on its own, that would go to public hearing for people to get a say in the matter.
How hard would it be for a town to prohibit a marijuana store? I mean, do they have to give lots of reasons why, or can they just say, no, we really don't want this?
My understanding is that they can say, no, they really don't want this. And we've already seen some cities and towns starting to take some time out and taking 6-month moratoriums to really look at this and figure out, how the rules coming down from the state that will take probably about a year to implement will work, and whether they're going to weigh in some local way. But it will probably be at least a year before, if this does indeed pass, before recreational marijuana is sold, probably January or February of next year.
Sure. And again, recognizing, Susan, that, you know, this is all very new and in flux and we don't really know yet. But Carmen, to you, so what have we seen elsewhere, again, in those states that have legal marijuana on the books? What about cities and towns that don't want to participate?
Sure. Yes. The legal states do have provisions for some local control. In Colorado, since that is my home state, I can speak to that one most comprehensively. 60% roughly of Colorado communities do not allow for adult use retail or commercial production within their jurisdiction.
60%?
Yes. It's
wow.
Kind of something that people don't really realize. It's
no.
Not necessarily, quote, everywhere when you come to Colorado. We have a lot of other great things in our state to come for, but so you don't necessarily see a dispensary in every town or, you know, come across a warehouse has a commercial grow wherever you go. It's kind of a misnomer. So it is generally concentrated in the Colorado Front Range, the Denver metro area, a few mountain communities, but it's generally where most of the people are. And in, like I said, with the ability to have some local control, you'll see county boards or local city officials having a measure, just kind of like a legislative body would, to either throw it to their own local voters to see what they feel, or if they just feel like this isn't something they want to participate in, then they just put the moratorium in as either temporary, or it can be seen as permanent, but those can usually be changed. So permanent is just kind of
for now.
Yeah, for now. Exactly. Yeah.
Let's take another call, and this is Kathy in Concord. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
This may sound like a silly question, but I wonder if the ski industry has thought about the implications for New Hampshire ski areas. It's not a silly question because I remember as parents of young children skiing in Western Canada that we were concerned about all the pot use going on in the particular ski area and said, we won't be back till the kids are grown. And we also read that in Colorado, skiing families are leaving to ski in Utah because they don't want their kids exposed to a lot of recreational use in the ski areas. And it does have a very strong presence in ski areas.
Kathy, thanks for the call. And I wonder, Carmen, I'll turn to you too, Susan, but Carmen, you first, if family skiing goes elsewhere, but more sort of young adult skiing heads to the places where marijuana is legal. Do you know anything about this, Carmen?
I've seen some reports from the Colorado kind of tourism and convention folks that show that people are still coming to Colorado. It doesn't necessarily make or break anybody's particular trip or vacation. But yes, I mean, you do hear anecdotal stories, but there's for every one that you hear of a family going somewhere else, you'll hear someone else saying, hey, we decided to come to Colorado because of it. But, you know, it hasn't shown to be that statistically different as far as our normal, you know, sunny blue skies and nice powder to come enjoy.
So. Well, and Susan, to you, I wonder where the very important tourism industry in Maine came down on this. It's an interesting question that Kathy asks.
You know, as far as I know, I have not heard from the tourism industry as a sector weighing in on question one here in Maine. I think it's a great question. I mean, I think questions like this will pop up around a number of ways that people interact with each other and what they will all be thinking, whether it's skiing or something else, about you know, the kind of activity that's going on around them. All I can think of is that, you know, it might be a boon on helmet sales. I don't know.
Well, it's hard.
Public prohibition. So, you know, in Colorado and in any other states, there should not be public use. So those people are still breaking the law. And if the ski resort wants to really crank down on any kind of public use, that's completely their right as a private, you know, company.
Well, and it's hard to gauge because here you have Kathy with some concerns and saying she doesn't want to go to a place that has a lot of marijuana use. But our emailer, Kyle, said earlier, we're going to lose tourists to Maine given that they've legalized. So thank you both for those comments. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Susan, what about consumer product safety? I wonder if Maine's proposal had some language in there about, you know, what types of products could be sold and what couldn't. We have heard stories and concerns about, you know, marijuana products looking like candy and little kids eating them and so forth.
Right. The edible question, the edible issue.
Right.
Yeah, it has. Those are some of the things that will be worked out in the rules over the next year. But even the last time I saw the proponents last week, even they were saying, "Look, you know, in the rules, we don't want edible gummy bear looking candy to be sold to children. That's not our goal." And that they would work hard. This is what they said, to make sure that there were strict rules around packaging and marketing to kids. And labeling for THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, strict labeling requirements on the packaging for products. But we just don't know yet how the rules will shake out around edibles and how candy and products like that will end up being sold at the retail stores.
Well, and here's an email from BJ and Sullivan, who says, I would like to have New Hampshire legalize marijuana. I'm 67. It's been years since I smoked, but I would like to have access to marijuana as I think it would help my chronic pain issues. And BJ says, why not? It's just a weed that people have been consuming since the dawn of history. It is our right. BJ, thank you for the email. And Susan, to you, we've been talking again about who was in favor, who was against in Maine. Were there really old-young divides or not? BJ says he's 67 and he thinks it should be legalized.
Yeah, that was another fascinating part, I think, of around the Maine debate. You know, you have some of the old hippies who really, really wanted to see it legalized in their lifetimes. But again, in Maine also, because of this rural Maine economy and what had been underground, the concern that people's livelihoods might be affected if big marijuana got some kind of an edge, even though in the Maine bill, small growers and caregivers who have been licensed by the state do get, you know, some front door treatment to getting the cultivation licenses as the law intends. But it was a mix. It really was. There were different people on, you know, some young people really in favor, some young people who were hip to the idea of the medical marijuana industry in Maine, understanding that, that might be a factor, what might happen to the economy and the people who are already in the door legitimately.
Well, and Carmen, you know, Susan's mentioned a couple times concerns about big pot and just like big tobacco coming in and dominating what has been sort of a local mom and pop industry. What role have you seen, Carmen, money playing, big money especially, in these state questions on either side of this issue, you know, pro-legalization or con?
Sure. There are, you know, cannabis industry interests, you know, across the country. They are, you know, in all sorts of states and in all sorts of levels as far as in the medical programs and as well in the commercial. But you see the from, you know, parent groups that tend to be opposed to some of the programs like that, or they at least want to make sure that the public's protected, kids are protected, things like that. Those are the groups you tend to see against it. You'll see law enforcement traditionally, as Susan said, kind of typically come out against it. But then you also see other law enforcement groups coming out in support of it because of what we mentioned earlier, the reduction in kind of in lower level marijuana-related crimes. So you'll see some industry funds coming in to support it. Sometimes you'll see other traditional alcohol companies will sometimes come out against it, but it's more of a coalition that you'll see form to fight and to support these efforts. It's not necessarily one face to either side of the pro or con side.
Does the pro side or the con side, Carmen, tend to have more money? I mean, who seems better organized and better funded?
That's a really good question. I've seen a mix, but there is usually kind of on any, especially if it's a ballot initiative question, you'll usually see more money on the pro side because that's the whole process that they need to get it on the ballot. So you have to
sure.
pay for signatures, you have to pay for the advertising, the public education campaigns. So you tend to see more money on that side, but it's not a hard and fast rule.
Susan, do you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, sure. Here in Maine, we were definitely lopsided. The pro side outraised and outspent the opponents by about more than 20 to 1. So it ended up being more than $2 million spent on question one, the ballot initiative here in Maine, and opponents just raising, I believe, a couple $100,000 at the last check.
Wow. So, Susan, last question for you, please. And again, thanks for being with us. Just remind us of the uncertainty around this this question and when things might get resolved.
Right. So tomorrow at 5 o'clock is the deadline for the opponents to bring in petition signatures if they want to formally request a recount in Maine. The difference separating the yes vote and the no vote is less than 5,000 votes. And so we're expecting that there probably will be a request.
All right. Susan, thank you again very much for taking time out.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Susan Sharon, Deputy News Director for Maine Public. We're going to turn our attention now to what happened in Massachusetts, another bordering state of New Hampshire that also approved adult recreational use of marijuana. Carmen Hansen will stay with us from the National Conference of State Legislatures. And joining us now is Martha Biebinger. She covers healthcare for WBUR and is creator of Healthcare Savvy. And Martha, great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, we just heard from Susan Sharon in Maine, Martha, about the very close vote there, maybe a recount. How about in Massachusetts? My understanding is it wasn't as close as Maine.
No, it was between a 7 and 8 point spread. 54% of voters weighed in favor of making recreational marijuana legal.
Yeah. So who in general was in favor of this in the Bay State, Martha, and who wasn't?
The supporters were people who believe that it's time to make marijuana legal. We've had a medical marijuana law in place. It was passed in 2012. We decriminalized marijuana in 2008. Many people saw this as a civil rights issue, feeling that marijuana is a way that police may stop and frisk more people of minorities. Many people thought that we should be taking advantage of the potential tax revenue. And then I think others just, again, as I said, just feel like it was the time had come. On the side of the opponents, we have many people who worry about the health effects. We have many people who worry about the effects of driving under the influence of marijuana. Some people who worry that there just isn't enough information about the long-term effects of marijuana as a recreational substance in society.
So in terms of the money, Susan said the pro-legalization side was far outspending the con side. What did you see
that,
in terms
yeah.
of money, Martha, in Massachusetts?
Well, the supporters were always well ahead. At one point, it was about a six-point spread. We never got to, I think Susan said 20. We were never at that kind of differential. And the final campaign finance reports showed that supporters outspent opponents 2-1.
Wow. And I read, Martha, that sort of the top leaders in the Bay State, you know, important state senators, lawmakers, the governor, that they were all against this. So people didn't seem to really care what they thought.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't discount the 46-47% of people who voted against this initiative. That's a strong voice there. But no, I don't think that those opinions. I don't know how many people the governor and the mayor of Boston and others, the attorney general swayed. I'm sure that they did have some influence, but I think the preponderance of folks feel like in Massachusetts that again, they've had some experience with medical marijuana. They just feel like maybe the campaign to make this illegal for so long has just been a little blown out of proportion.
Well, Martha and Carmen, let's go back to our listeners. And Bill joins us from Gorham. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Good morning. It's just my thought that as I'm driving down the interstate towards Concord, I see signs with concerns about opiate use.
Yeah.
And apparently there's a lot of transference from medical marijuana. I mean, medical opiate use to addiction and abuse. I'm just wondering if the increase in availability of medical marijuana or marijuana as a whole might mitigate that issue. I might be a crazy idea, but I suspect there's the same, like the gentleman that called in that was concerned with chronic pain. And apparently marijuana is an effective tool against chronic pain. So just a thought if there's a nexus between the two.
Well, Bill, thank you for calling in. And Carmen and Martha, neither of you are health experts, but Carmen, I think I can ask you that this idea has come up before, right? It's something I'm hearing a lot more about from people who come on this show or call into the show. Could marijuana to ease pain help with the opioid crisis that we're seeing in some states, including New Hampshire? I'm wondering how often this comes up in these marijuana campaigns.
Yes, it definitely comes up, and there have been some recent studies. They are kind of two separate issues, though. Like I'm not a medical doctor, first of all, so just a policy wonk. So you will see a few groups that have looked into this issue, and they have shown in a few studies that states that have medical marijuana programs may have a slightly lower rate of overdose deaths or overdose deaths due to opioids. However, it may not be statistically significant. And then the old adage with social science research is correlation does not equal causation necessarily. But the RAND organization has a pretty comprehensive study on this, and there are other peer-reviewed studies that you can find on that issue.
Okay, Bill, thank you for the call. We'll take a lot more of your calls in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how recreational marijuana fared in this year's elections, with 4 out of the 5 states looking at this question, approving it last week: Massachusetts, Maine, California, and Nevada. We're finding out more on efforts and new laws in our neighboring states of Massachusetts and Maine. We talked about Maine earlier with Susan Sharon at Maine Public. With us now from WBUR in Boston is Martha Biebinger. She covers healthcare for WBUR. And with us for the hour is Carmen Hansen. She's program manager at National Conference of State Legislature. She's been following marijuana policy for a long time. And Martha, back to you. We talked to Susan again about this in Maine. What about local zoning? If a town doesn't want a marijuana store, what rights does it have?
They have to mount a referendum. So there has to be a local vote to ban stores in the area if they want to eliminate them, if they want to keep them out altogether. If they can't, if the town managers can't succeed in that venue, they can limit the number of stores, and they can limit where they are located. They can do, they have, there's some other options that can limit hours and advertising and that sort of thing. But the default is that stores would be allowed to open in any city or town.
That's interesting. So the town would have to organize a whole separate vote, Martha, if it wanted to keep a shop completely out.
Yeah, and it's a little complicated because the town officials aren't really allowed to take a stand on public issues and be the campaign organizers themselves. They'd have to have a local group take charge of mounting that referendum campaign.
So it sounds like if a town or city in Massachusetts absolutely did not want a marijuana shop, it might have a hard time saying no.
It may have a hard time. There are definitely, you know, city and town managers, mayors, city councils have looked at the votes, many of them in their towns, and there are some communities where the vote was lopsided against the question. And so many communities, and some along the New Hampshire border, feel that, they would have a good shot at reversing the vote within their town and keeping the shops out. But again, it's the logistics of being able to mount and finance that campaign.
Sure. Well, and lots of logistics as these things, you know, start to be put into place. Let's go back to our listeners. And Alan joins us from one of those border towns you mentioned, Martha. He's calling in from Nashua. Hi, Alan. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Yes. The Pheasant Lane Mall in Nashua, the Massachusetts line goes through the south end of the mall. So there could be a marijuana store in the south end of the Pheasant Lane Mall in Nashua, and people could walk there and walk back purchasing marijuana. I don't know what the penalty is or how this would all work out.
So
it would have an effect.
Yeah, and Alan, I don't know specifically how that would work, given that, as you say, a little bit of the mall dips into Massachusetts. But the police chief in Nashua was quoted in the Union Leader as saying, hey, Massachusetts people, don't bring your pot here. If you bring it, we'll arrest you. Thank you for the call, Alan. I do wonder, Carmen, about border states and what happens to a neighboring state when its you know, its neighbors approve legal marijuana.
Definitely. There are can be some impacts. And like I said, because I'm a resident of Colorado, I can speak most to that. Some of the surrounding states, no one else is legalized around Colorado, and only New Mexico and Arizona both have medical programs. But as far as other local law enforcement across our borders, they do find some marijuana kind of leaking out of the state, so to speak, but that was illegal before any kind of legalization of adult use or medical in Colorado, and it still is illegal. So if people choose to break laws, then they can suffer the consequences in both, you know, under Colorado law and other states' laws.
I think when Colorado approved its legal marijuana law, Carmen, there were lots of fears and complaints from neighboring states, right? I mean, they said, you know, this is going to cause a lot of cross-border problems for us.
Yes, there were concerns, and you know, with anything, there are border issues, and this is just kind of another issue that states try to work out between themselves. As far as you know, the intent is to not impact other states, but you know, people still make decisions and choose to break, you know, those laws and other laws. So,
well, and given how small the states are here in New England, there's a lot of cross-border traffic. So, Alan, thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry we couldn't specifically answer your question, but I appreciate you joining us. The number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's a comment from Facebook. Selma chimes in. She says, meanwhile, in New Hampshire, chronic pain and most autoimmune chronic pain disorders are non-qualifying for medical marijuana. Martha, we talked earlier about the conflict in Maine over medical marijuana versus this new legalized recreational marijuana industry. What did you hear about that in Massachusetts? Were the medical folks concerned about the influx of the legal marijuana businesses?
You know, they were not particularly vocal, Laura, and I think The act is written so that they essentially get first cut at opening the shops. So, for example, on January 1st, 2008, if the new Cannabis Control Commission is not up and ready to go with licensing new shops, the dispensaries, the existing medical marijuana dispensaries, can start selling weed for recreational use. When you apply for a license for one of these new shops, experience in the industry will count. So there are many ways that they will have an advantage going into this new medical marijuana industry. But there are some really interesting points of conflict as well. So, for example, the medical marijuana folks here have to be nonprofit. That's not the case on the recreational side. When you buy marijuana for medical purposes, you don't pay taxes. You will for recreational. So you can imagine possibly in the same shop, some people would be paying a tax on their
12% in Massachusetts, right, Martha?
What's that?
12%.
Well, right now, it looks like the legislature is going to weigh in on that, meaning they're going to try to increase it. Yeah. But but that's what the act says. You're correct.
So in one particular establishment, you know, one person could be buying medical marijuana not taxed, and the other person could be buying recreational marijuana and paying, you know, maybe up to 12% of tax.
Right. That's speculation, assuming that a medical marijuana dispensary would also open for recreational, but yes.
You know what else I'm curious about in Massachusetts, Martha, is the issue of homegrown. And again, we looked at this earlier with Carmen and Susan in Maine. What does Massachusetts law say about homegrown?
It says 6 plants per person, maximum of 12 per household, and that part of the act takes effect on December 15th.
So soon.
Soon.
And
yeah.
Will that be taxed?
No. The state treasurer is not happy about that provision. She would like to actually eliminate that part of the act so that all marijuana recreational sales would be taxable. It's hard to imagine that would sort of directly fly in the face of the will of the voters if you took that part out right now. I think that would be hard to sink, but we'll see. We'll see. This is all very fluid right now. The governor, the state treasurer, the attorney general, and many leaders on Beacon Hill are trying to figure out what sort of amendments to the act they will propose.
Sure, because as we discussed earlier, it's hard to imagine, Martha, that if someone's growing, you know, 3 plants for their own use in the backyard or in the kitchen or wherever, that, you know, state authorities could come in and tax them for that. So it's hard to think about how they could tax homegrown.
Yeah, no, there isn't really a model for doing that.
All right, let's go back to our listeners. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. James is up next. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Yeah, what about the feds decriminalizing?
Say that again, James.
What about the federal government? They haven't decriminalized it yet.
This is an excellent question, James. Thank you for calling in. And we should talk a little bit about that, Carmen. He's right. According to the federal government, marijuana is still an illegal substance, an illegal drug. So how is that shaking out with these states that are moving to legalize marijuana?
Sure. Well, I personally don't track all of the federal activities on this. You know, we don't generally prognosticate on what could happen there. But the feds have decided through our current administration, the Department of Justice has issued a couple memos saying that as long as the states that have both adult use and medical programs are operating and regulating in a very thorough manner and they don't seem to be having any problems with their programs, that they would not actively seek to prosecute anybody on, like, as long as they're following their state's laws. However, if illegal activity is found to be happening in those states, the feds will come in and usually work with local law enforcement to shut those things down. It happens in pretty much every state that I've heard of with legal and adult use and medicinal programs. So it still does happen. It still is illegal on the federal level. But as long as you're following your state's laws, you're generally seen as, you know, compliant with the existing programs and rules.
Now, Carmen, I remember reading something, this is a couple years ago, so this may have changed, but I remember reading something that in terms of businesses in this field, that the fact that it's still an illegal drug federally does create problems in terms of banking and credit because there are federal rules that need to be followed there. Is that still the case? Or given that this is growing so much, have these marijuana businesses figured a way out of this?
There are still challenges with taxes and credit and things like that because you cannot use like debit cards, credit cards legally according to the federal banking laws. And I'm not a banking laws expert.
Sure.
I stick on the health side, but it is a challenge. Some dispensaries in Colorado in particular will allow use of cards, but they have like a kind of an isolated system. They're kind of with working their own internal financial method or process. They're not necessarily using interstate processors to transfer their money. So, but it's largely seen as a cash business, and businesses tend to pay their taxes to the state in cash or in money orders, things like that, because it is quite difficult for them to get any kind of financial services through a traditional bank or credit union.
Okay. Well, James, it's a good point. Thank you for calling in. And Ben joins us from Manchester. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Yeah, I'm curious. There's a lot of attention paid to the tax revenue that's going to happen from, you know, both legalizing or decriminalizing. I think there's a lot of missing of the actual funds that will be created from the elimination of minor prosecution for marijuana. A lot of people are in prison for small amounts of marijuana or paying fines and such, where there's a lot of police action and funds being thrown in that direction that would be eliminated from this. I was wondering if there's any sort of research that can put brass tacks on that for us.
Yeah, Ben, thank you. It's a question that has come up a lot. And Martha, I'm guessing it came up in Massachusetts debate, the idea that do you save money because police don't have to go over, you know, go after low-level users? Or does it cost money because there is this whole new regulatory structure? How does that shake out in Massachusetts, Martha?
Well, I don't think we know. I don't think, Ben, I can't really give you brass tacks on whether there would be what the sort of cost benefit analysis is there.
Yeah, you know, we don't know yet.
The mayors, but we don't know. The mayors who supported the question liked the idea of being able to shift their resources to crimes or drug trafficking or any number of other things that they felt were more significant than the work they were doing on marijuana. But you also have many local town officials who are very worried about how they will, what the increased demand will be to police things that come as a result of this. So drinking while under the influence, or maybe some trafficking that happens out of homes that are growing. I mean, you hear these sorts of things. Maybe they're more fear, but we just don't know yet.
Yeah, well, it's a good question, Ben. Thank you. And it does seem, both of you, that there's a lot of emphasis in our conversation this hour on money, whether this will cost more than we think, whether this is a good source of tax revenue for states. Here's another money question from Tom and Rye, who says, do any of your guests know if big tobacco is involved in the legalization push across the country? Tom says companies like Philip Morris certainly know how to grow, distribute, and lobby for their products, and it seems that a transition to marijuana would be easy, an easy one for their industry. Tom says, I have heard that big tobacco was hiring pharmacists in all 50 states to spearhead their effort. Do you have any insights? Carmen, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I'd love your thoughts on how much we know about the money forces that are pushing this.
Sure. I don't know of any interest of the tobacco companies in this issue. I have not seen it or experienced in Colorado or any other states that has had a legalization effort.
Martha, was this the concern in Massachusetts that this was really being driven by, you know, big tobacco or big pot?
So slightly different. So thank you for that, the last part of that question, because big pot is really the concern that I hear. I don't hear the transference of the tobacco industry per se, but I hear people worried that the marijuana industry will mirror the rise of big tobacco and become more of a, you know, very top-down corporate entity that uses influence to determine what people use, how much, when, where. It's more of the modeling idea than an actual transfer.
Okay. Well, Tom, thank you for the question. And Martha, just remind us when this system of legalized recreational marijuana is going to be fully up and running in the Bay State?
Well, we don't really know when it's going to be fully up and running. I can tell you that on the 15th, possession of marijuana will no longer carry a fine of any kind up to an ounce, that you'll be able to have an ounce on your possession in public. You won't be able to use in public, but you'll be able to carry an ounce in public. You'll be able to start home grow, and you'll be able to have up to 10 ounces at home as long as the other 9 ounces are under lock and key. The stores are, according to the Act, supposed to open on January 1st, 2018. But the legislature, there are rumblings about pushing that deadline forward into later in 18 or 19.
Okay, so in terms of home use, home grow, sounds like that's coming pretty quickly. But in terms of, you know, walking down the street and going to a store, that's a little further off down the line, Martha.
Correct.
Okay. Martha, thank you very much for taking time out. Really appreciate it. Good to talk to you.
Same.
Martha Biebinger, she covers healthcare for WBUR, is the creator of Healthcare Savvy. Carmen Hansen, thanks again for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura. Always a pleasure.
That's Carmen Hansen, program manager at the National Conference of State Legislatures. For the past decade, she's been following marijuana policy in the states. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our intern is Liz Torrey. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.